Hi, my name is John Kim. I'm a therapist who went through his own rebirth many years ago, and I've been documenting my journey ever since, sharing my life lessons and revelations. I believe in casual over clinical, with you instead of at you. I come unrehearsed on purpose because self-help doesn't have to be so complicated. Annie.
Hey, John.
How are you?
How are you going today? I'm well.
I want to start with you and your story because you're not just someone who talks about this by something you've learned in textbooks. You actually have personal experience. It's a lifestyle for you. So I want to know how you got here. So where were you and how you got here? So you can start anywhere you want.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a long one, but like the watered down version of it is that I've basically engaged with every relationship style, right? I was married. I was with that person for 18 years. We opened our marriage like so many people did during the pandemic. We explored non-monogamy. We explored swinging. We explored DS relationships. And then finally, we explored polyamory. That relationship ultimately did not make it.
Wait, real quick. So, what do you say to people who say it didn't make it because you guys opened it?
Yeah.
So, why did it not make it? Because that would be the assumption, right?
Right. That's absolutely the assumption. Everybody thinks like, oh yeah, polyamory is what like ended the marriage. Right. That was an accelerant, right? Like it shed light in all the cracks of that relationship and definitely accelerated our breakup and made it happen a lot faster than it probably would. We probably had another 10 years if it hadn't been for the non-monogamy, but I was always leading that relationship. And so I think that that's always people's fear, right? Is they're like, well, if I open this Pandora's box, is it going to end my relationship with this person? And my answer to that is yeah, maybe. Like I don't sugarcoat that at all. If like somebody is very worried that non-monogamy or participation in non-monogamy could end their relationship, if they don't want their relationship to change, don't engage.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about non-monogamy, and I think there's a lot of people doing it for the wrong reasons. And then they open it and then they're like, they can't handle it. Right. So, the whole topic today is going to be, is it for me? Right. And maybe you can help us, kind of decipher through it. And if it is for you, some questions to ask yourself, but why do you think this is such a hot topic now? Why do you think that this is, kind of commercialized? Because, you know, even like 5-6 years ago, I mean, no one was talking about this stuff and now it's like exploded. Why do you think that is?
I think part of it's a product of the pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're sitting with ourselves long enough to have the luxury, and it is a luxury to be able to think about different relationship styles, the way we want to present, right? There was a lot of benefit to the world shutting down. I think that people really took a hard look
at all areas of their life, right?
Like, I mean, that's what happened.
Right. What makes me happy?
Yeah. And so like, I think that's part of it, right? I think there's, a little bit of like a social movement happening with like just the self, right? With queerness and sexuality and all of these other things, despite what we would see out in the world, we would think, no, like, you know, maybe we're getting more conservative. I don't think we are. And I think that Gen Z really pushes this narrative too.
Yeah. What is your, what is your relationship model? What is your personal practicing right now as far as under non-monogamy?
Yeah, so I'm a relationship anarchist now because I felt that the polyamorous label was a little bit too restrictive for me, actually.
In what way?
I think that. Yeah, I'll explain this because I think it's a really important distinction in polyamory. And this gets into like, who does non-monogamy work for best? And part of that is that I think when you talk about the definition of polyamory, which is multiple loving romantic sexual relationships, I think that that label to romantic and sexual relationships is too exclusive for me because it removes asexual people and aromantic people from the conversation who are amazing partners.
And so you could love someone and not be sexual with them is what you're saying.
Correct. And so I have a queer platonic partner and I also have a romantic partner. Mm-hmm. For me, as I am sifting through the layers of trauma that have come out of, you know, my life and my work and the things I'm doing, I have found that this is a structure that works really well for me right mm-hmm. now. But don't get me wrong. I've done a lot of dirty things. I've done a lot of fun things. I've done a lot of sexy things. I've done a lot of chaotic things. I've learned that those things are valuable and fun and can be a very specific encapsulated part of your life, mm-hmm. which is really just to say that I think a lot of people also think that once I ring this bell of non-monogamy, I have to do it all the time, right? Like if I'm polyamorous, I'm polyamorous forever. My whole thing is that monogamy can also be a super radical choice,
yeah.
but it's not a choice if you don't know you're making it.
Like if monogamy is just the default, meaning it's all there is, and if that's what you believe, then in a way it's not a choice. Sure. Someone asked, what's the difference between a platonic partner and a friend? Yeah. So if you're loving someone and you're not having sex or being intimate sexually with that person, wouldn't that just be a friend, they're asking?
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, the difference is commitment. I mean, some people do, I will admit, mm-hmm. have sex with their queer platonic partners or platonic partners. I happen to not do that anymore. Mm-hmm. We used to, we don't now. For me, it's just a level of commitment, right?
Yeah.
And how we're showing up for each other and the agreements being explicit, right? Like a lot of agreements in friendship are implicit. We just like, oh, this is the commitment I have to this friend, right? But it hasn't been explicitly discussed. But in my platonic partnership, we have discussed those elements.
So you're someone who helps people navigate, who coaches people on this. What do you find the biggest problem as far as doing this the wrong way, right? If someone and their partner is curious, what are the not only the misconceptions, but what are the things that people are doing that they shouldn't do, because then it becomes, you know, hurtful, damaging. They're just setting themselves up for a huge train wreck.
I think opening as a couple is super, super hard, mm-hmm. right? I think that, so if you're opening as a couple versus approaching it fresh as a solo poly or single poly person, that's a little different, right? So there's some unique challenges to that. So if you have codependency, mm-hmm. if you have a lot of triggers, right? I think what happens is couples are like, all right, we're going to like try this thing out. But then they are having to deconstruct all of the mononormative, heteronormative, and codependency things that exist in their relationship already, as well as trying to practice non-monogamy. That is too much. It's too much.
A lot of activation.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah.
And so I think that if couples are really curious about non-monogamy in general, there's a couple of recommendations that I make. Mm-hmm. I think the first is, I like to say, even though some people are like, well, you go non-monogamous, polyamorous, and then you get into relationship anarchy. No. Explore relationship anarchy first. Undo your mononormative and heteronormative ideas. Do you run your own schedule, for example, mm-hmm. or does your spouse do that, right? Like, do you take time away? Like, can you do that?
When
things?
You say relationship anarchy, can you explain for people who don't know what you're talking about? I know that's kind of your mission statement.
It scares people.
Yeah, I think anarchy, sounds kind of chaotic and violent.
Yeah,
and,
it does. You know. I have a friend who instead, he's like, I don't like it. That word bothers me. And he calls it relationship autonomy, which I actually really like.
Yeah. I like that a lot too.
But it's super, super simple, right? It's super simple. It is just that the relationship that you are in is crafted for the two people in it. And you don't have to subscribe to the normal social script that relationships follow, right? So that might mean that, for example, for me, right? Like I don't live with my partner. He lives with my other partner, right? We don't live together. Even if we got married tomorrow, we probably wouldn't live together, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like undoing a lot of those shoulds that we feel like we have to participate in.
So let me stop there, because this is really important. This is primer. This is step one. Before you even put your toe in non-monogamy, in your relationship, what does, you call it anarchy, someone else calls it autonomy.
I would call it
customization.
Yes.
How would you customize your relationship if you weren't following old blueprints, if it wasn't about the shoulds and what, you know, marriage or relationship should look like. Like you're saying, why can't you live in different houses?
Exactly.
Why can't you, right?
You can.
Yeah, so just starting there in your relationship, how can we customize this so it works for both of us, because we can't fulfill every need.
Yes.
Our partners can't fulfill every need.
You know? This is a kind of monogamous thing we're fed, right? Is that this person completes you, right? For me, when my marriage ended, the thing that was so important to me was that my first and best partner is me, right? And I was with my ex-husband from 18. I'm almost 39. So this was a very hard leap for me, right? I was like, wait, I don't want to be partnered to myself. That sounds boring and also lonely, right? And so I think for me, like, learning to kind of put myself, and this is why I feel like one of the concepts for me personally that's very triggering for people is the decentralization of romance, right? How much power, centralization, does it have in your life? Because if romance has all the power, where's your power, right? So for me,
what do you mean by romance having all the power? Are you talking about us participating in Valentine's Day and buying expensive chocolate?
No, I love Valentine's Day.
What do you mean by romance having the power? You mean so like your life revolves around just romance and
finding that romantic partner as a starting point, a jumping off point, and then making them your everything, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, like I am so deeply, deeply in love and invested in my partner, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have the central role in my life.
Yeah.
I have the central role in my life, right? So I feel like that's part of, like, for me, coming into, like, the maturity to be able to practice a different relationship style in general.
So it's like you build your life first, right?
Yes.
What makes you happy, fulfill, you know, your needs, your passion. And then sharing that with a partner instead of the other way around, where it's like, I used to say, ask yourself where are you going and then who are you going with? Mm. If you switch the order, you'll be going alone. Yep. Because most of my life, 20s, 30s, you know, hopeless romantic and just buying into, like, you find your one person, picket fence, rest of your life, we die together kind of thing, right? Till death do us part, which now I don't believe in. But I don't believe in it because I think it's toxic to start with that. It just sounds so claustrophobic and trapping.
Here's the thing. We want to believe in it. We want to. Right?
Well, because it's romantic and it's sexy romantic, and it's lovey,
right? But the problem is that so many of us get to a certain point in life and we're like, shit. We get that. The divorce comes through, the affair happens, the, you know, the thing that's been dogging us our whole life comes upon us, right? And those are the moments, those crisis moments in which we're like, where do I stand in terms of myself and my own life? It's hard.
Well, also, you know, you have kids fast, and then when you have children, you know, you definitely, you know, sacrifice a lot. I think losing yourself is more, can be more amplified if you now have children, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a... Children are a loss of autonomy for a certain amount of years too, right? They're dependents, and as they should be, right? And so these are some of the ways that I encourage people to, like, really think about, like, where is, because, you know, in long-term relationships, and not just marriages, but long-term relationships, we slowly piecemeal away our autonomy in ways that we don't realize we've done. And so I think it's important to regain your composure and your autonomy first before you start introducing new people into the relationship. I will put a caveat on this, though. I think that swingers have a pretty high success rate as far as what they do. And part of the reason for that is that, and I don't know if you know this, but a lot of swingers consider themselves functionally monogamous. And that is because
they're doing it together.
They're doing it together, and they have emotional boundaries. They have emotional boundaries that they are not getting into with other people, right? And there are, like, there's a very, I don't know, like, I guess a well-worn standard with swinging is, like, this is how we communicate. This is what the lines are. You don't approach people in this way, right? And so they have a pretty high success rate and a pretty high marital satisfaction rate, actually, as well.
I think we need to come up with a different term than swingers, because I'm 50 and I have my 1 foot in the 80s. And so when I hear the word swinger, I instantly think, yeah, and I think like 70s and like bellboy. I have this, you know, or like, you know, old people in Palm Springs. Yeah. I have this very judgmental view of swingers, and with everything that's happening today, and the customization of all relationship models, we need to think of a new word that isn't tainted, like swingers. It just sounds so outdated.
I think it's funny. I think it's funny. Like, and people swing in different types of ways, but like the swinger community is like alive and proud. Like, they are very, very happy of where they're at. Right. And like, it is a form of non-monogamy, in my estimation. I think we should definitely include it in the umbrella, right?
Yeah, even though you are participating together as a couple, it is still non-monogamy because you guys are, you know, engaging with
you
other people.
You don't have that sexual exclusivity that is kind of that marker of monogamy. But, like, really, it doesn't matter what you call it, right? At the end of the day, like, labels are only helpful if they're helping us define something.
What do you say to people who say, look, loving one person over time is how you hit high notes and you go deep with that one person? Spreading yourself thin and loving multiple people will make all the people, make the relationships like lukewarm or not. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's not necessarily so, right? Like some relationships I do think that you learn different things in long-term relationships, right? But when you're polyamorous, and this is something I talk about, right? I think polyamory in particular, because polyamory is the loving relationships and that sort of thing, multiple loving relationships.
Yeah, and not just physical.
Not just physical. And also, like, these are deep, meaningful, committed relationships. And a lot of polyamorous people that I know have been involved 8, 9, 10 years with some of their people, right? So those are long-term relationships. But we also know that a lot of long-term dyadic monogamous relationships end in divorce. In fact, about 50%.
Yeah.
So we can't hold it up as some standard of like, this is what works and this is what doesn't.
Right. You mean I just think that the proof is in the divorce rate.
Right.
Saying.
I mean, yeah. But also, you know, I think that love is not pie either, right? Like we love our, and this is kind of comes back to that relationship anarchy, right? I love my child. I love my mother. I love my queer platonic partner. I love my boyfriend. They are different types of love. They are all different types of love, but one is not less than another. And so I think that that's important to keep in mind too. Like, even if you're in love with two people, those loves are not going to be identical.
Yeah.
And that's, but I will say, I think that cognitively, that's a lot to wrap your head around.
Yes. And also, you know, who's got the time and all of that.
Yeah.
But the biggest factor, it seems like, is the jealousy piece, right? So whether it is with Polly, obviously, because you are loving someone, you are giving your heart to someone else. I believe that love is limitless. I do believe that each connection, and it doesn't matter if it's platonic or not, is going to be different, and that's the point. How can love be the same when we're completely different beings with different stories? You know, I see our chemistry as a swirl and like a snowflake instead of a snowball, and so each connection is going to be uniquely different, and that's kind of the point, right? So I don't think love is the same. But I do think that love is limitless.
Yeah.
You know, we don't max out at, you know, we don't say to ourselves we can only have four friends.
Right.
That's all our hearts can hold, or you know, four family members. So the big things usually is jealousy. So whether you are just physical with someone, or you are giving your heart to someone, and it seems like Polly's harder for many people because they could separate physical from heart.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know, maybe that's a generalization. But the jealousy piece, what do you, I mean, it seems like that's the biggest, generally, but what do you?
I feel like, well, when people talk about jealousy, right, like they have this sort of assumption, for whatever reason, that polyamorous people must be less jealous overall. I am here to tell you, I am so jealous. I am such a jealous person, right?
Yes.
I'm jealous of the wind when it touches your face, right? Like, that's me. I don't think that I'm less jealous than anybody else, but I may be better at dealing with the emotion of jealousy.
Right, processing it, and yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And that's the key. And I also want to say that there have been times, there are times in my non-monogamous journey that I have said, it's insurmountable right now. Like, it's just insurmountable, and I need to shut mm-hmm. it down, right? Like, and that is also okay. Like, you have to know where your limits are. And it's okay to say, you know what? I can't do this emotional work right now. I'm not adding any new partners. I'm not adding anything new because mm-hmm. I can't handle it emotionally, mentally, for whatever reason, right? That's one thing. But I also think that in terms of, like, right, I'm a mom, you're a dad, right? My daughter comes home sometime and says, oh, my friend made a new friend and I am so jealous, right? And this is the moment where we need to catch people, societally speaking, mm-hmm. right? We tell people to avoid jealousy because you just don't want to feel yeah. it. But the point is, we feel it anyway. We feel it in friendships. We feel it sure. in work situations, right? We feel it anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's better to give people tools to deal with these things so that if the feelings are too big, you can identify that, yeah. right? Like, you can say to yourself, this is not a feeling I'm equipped to deal with or can deal with right now, and I have to know my limit, instead of, I never want to feel that at all, which I'm going to probably do anyway, but mm-hmm. I'm going to ignore it.
I was running a retreat just a few weekends ago, and the retreaters go home after dinner, and so staff, you know, then hangs out, and we it becomes a slumber party, and we were talking about definitions of love and how the world is changing. And I was really sitting with this, and I was thinking, you know, the highest, what would be my definition of the highest form of love? And I thought to myself, it would be allowing whoever you love to have any experience that excites them while they're on this planet, sexual or not, you know, trips, business, food. And if it's sexual, that should be okay too. I'm not saying that's easy to execute, but I thought, like, not getting in the way of someone living their life and what makes them feel alive, to me, would be, I think, the highest form of love, right? For you, what would it be? What would be your definition of, like, the highest form of love?
That's a really great question. The highest form of love for me, I think when you said it, the first thing that came to my mind was freedom,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
If I love somebody, I want them to feel free. And so for me, even whatever the relationship choice is, right? So let's say a partner and I are monogamous and they came to me and said, this doesn't make me feel good anymore.
Yeah.
I want to offer them the freedom to have that conversation with me and for us to make real choices, or to say, I got to take this trip. This is really important to me. I want to, like you were saying, try this dinner, try this experience, right? Mm-hmm. I think Glennon Doyle puts this in a really great way, is that love is feeling both held and free, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. I always think about that quote when I think about, like, what is love really? And I think it's like, it's letting go of that fear of the lack of attachment. Right?
Yeah.
Which is something I struggle with a lot. I think I actively have to catch myself a lot in that, what does this mean for me, right? And come back to that full cycle to get all the way back to impermanence.
What do you think is going to, how do you think all of this is going to unfold just in our world? How do you think it's going to play out as far as the expansion of this? Is it going to, you know, create new definitions? Is it going to divide us? Is it going to be a phase? What do you think is going to happen with all this talk about non-monogamy and new relationship models? Which, I mean, there's tons of books
there's
on
so
it.
Many.
I mean, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Apps,
I mean,
and all sorts of stuff.
In my highest vision, I think that it just becomes one of many choices.
Yeah, like, it's
right?
Not,
like,
that big of a deal. No one's
here's
talking.
My,
yeah.
Like, if I was being an idealist, which I am a little bit, I would say that when two people come together in a loving relationship that's intentional, they sit down and go, so what kind of relationship do you think you want to practice? Right? Mm-hmm. Instead of assuming we're going to be monogamous, which they can absolutely choose, they come together and say, this is kind of what I'm thinking, this is kind of what I'm thinking, and wow, isn't this great? We're on the same page, and this is what we want, and we're crafting something that's really, really beautiful for both of us, instead of assuming that if I like you and you like me, we're going to get married, have kids, do the whole thing, and then, you know, divorce around 40.
Yes. You know, I wonder if this would help smash the internal clock. When I had a full caseload, it was, and this is why I wrote the book Single on Purpose, it was a lot of women who felt the urge or that ticking clock. I'm getting older. I need to, you know, find my person, get married, have a kid. I've got 2.5 years. This pressure for them to, you know, chase that. And I wonder if all of this conversation will free that up a little bit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I hope so. I wanted to ask you, like, why do you think, as like a therapist, that people are so triggered by non-monogamy? Mm. Like, what do you think triggers that in them?
I mean, I know even for me who, and if I wasn't a therapist, I would definitely be more narrow-minded, but being a therapist and having conversations like this definitely helps, you know, stretch me. I think because I'm 50, that I grew up, and a lot of this has to do with societal conditioning, patriarchy, culture. I grew up in a world where you're supposed to love one person for the rest of your life. And I tried. In 29, I got married, and I thought that was it. I'm done. We're going to, you know, live and die together. And of course, it didn't work out. And I realized, oh, there's a lot of, you know, issues and stuff. I think I, like everyone else, was chasing the poster, you know, the trailer instead of watching the documentary. And so it also has to do with identity. I think it has to, so like, if that's my core belief and suddenly the world is saying, oh, you don't have to do that and you can customize your relationship, you could love more than one person, it like, it fucks with my identity. It kind of gets you to say, oh my God, who am I? And so that resistance, I think, is the pushback that we're getting from a lot of people. Like, what are you talking about? That's crazy. That's wrong. Then it becomes a I'm right, you're wrong kind of thing, you know, tug of war.
Yeah, I would love to see more people just say, it's not right for me, instead of it's not right.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that's the bridge, right? Like, I don't care. I don't care what your relationship style is. Ideally, you should just do whatever you want.
Yeah, do what makes you happy, sure.
Yeah, I think that people have to be really authentic about that. But I would like to see more people just say, yeah, not right for me, but sounds good. I hope you're having a good time.
Absolutely. And also, not right for me can be right now, but I'll tell you what, my definition of love today, 50, is very different than my 30s, my 20s, or, you know, in college.
Absolutely, so. Absolutely. I think, you know, there's something that happens with experience and you learn, oh, this isn't exactly what I thought it was. It's a little bit different. And I think that we should be making that evolution as people, you know, as we're coming through. Like, my definition of good love is not what it used to be. Not even 5 years ago.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that changes things.
I've been in a hot tub with many men talking about this type of thing, and what I got from it was, I think everyone is curious to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Like, the more pushback you have, that person usually is more curious, and the pushback is like tied to like this anxiety. But I think a lot of people are curious because for most of us, we haven't experienced this. It's like a new flavor at the, you know, or it's a new color in the crayon box.
Yeah,
I don't even know how to spell this. What color is this? I mean, I red, blue, orange. What is this?
Yeah,
and so people are curious.
When people are curious like that, I think it's good. I think exploration is not commitment, right? And I think that that's important. Like, you can have these conversations in your relationship without anything happening, right? Yeah. Like, you can be like, "What do you think about that?" And somebody can be like, "I'm kind of curious about that," right? And that doesn't that doesn't mean anything about the relationship that you're in. And it doesn't mean that you're making a choice or doing something different, right? Yeah. And I think that even that feels overwhelming for people.
The two words that have been very kind of thematic for me and kind of lighting up in neon in my life when it comes to love and relationships is possession and permission. Mm. And I used to be possessive and I used to not ask for permission. But today, those are very important words, not only for me, but also I think just, you know, the world in general.
Yeah.
And if you explore possession, meaning letting go of what that looks like, permission, asking for, don't assuming, creating a safe space, building trust, all of this stuff, the product of that may be very different. The way that you show up in relationships is probably going to be very different just based on those two words, you know, if you look at things through that lens. And so I think that's what's happening is I think the world, because we are living in a world where people are more living authentically and they're not scared to truly show up in all areas of their life, whether, you know, it's at work or in relationships as themselves. And we're noticing the ripple of that. So it's not like it's going to go around relationships. I mean, it's going to go through everything. Yeah. And so the swell right now, we're seeing it in relationships. But for some reason, because of our culture, when it comes to love, they're like, don't fuck with love. You could tell us to, you know, have, you know, 3-day work weeks and all this kind of stuff and Zoom and, but don't touch love. Don't fuck with love. Love is sacred. And people are fucking with love. So,
yeah. You know. I mean, and it does, right? Because it makes you question, right? It makes you question the nature of love. Like when we separate out concepts of sexuality and romance and sensuality inside of our love relationships, we really get down to brass tacks about how we're showing up and what we're gaining. And the fact that a partner may not meet all of our needs, but we still love them, that can be really trigger inducing or make people feel inadequate or make them feel.
Oh, wait, we lost your voice. Wait, we lost your voice. I think maybe your Bluetooth or something. I don't know what happened. We say something? Okay, there you go.
Sorry.
Oh,
yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah. Just for a second.
Yeah, so that's a really rough thing for people to absorb in relationship.
Well, I'm trying to put myself in the position of people listening to this and trying to think of questions that they would ask. Anyone who is curious about this and wants to kind of take a first step, what would be some advice or some thoughts?
I think you should definitely, you know, read some literature. I absolutely recommend the Relationship Anarchy Manifesto. It is a very short document. Just Google Relationship Anarchy Manifesto. It's by Andy Nordgren. That's one of my favorite documents. I think get really clear about what your values are. And the biggest thing that I would say to anyone who wants to explore non-monogamy is go slowly. Slowly and intentionally. Because a lot of people go, and I say a lot of people, I'm talking about me, right? Like I went in all the way in.
Very fast.
Full chaos. I was like, let's just do all the things, like all the freedom, whatever. And you know, that has a value too. So if people want to do that, they can. But it's also a very chaotic way to go about, you know, it took me a long time to sort of calm down in my practice. And so if people can learn anything from the chaos that I unleash in my polyamory, it's go slow and be intentional and be clear about what it is that you want, because otherwise you may really wind up imploding some really valuable relationships or just put yourself through a lot of hell, in all honesty, emotional and otherwise.
I mean, at the end of the day, if you do this ethically and you're communicating and you're honest and your dial is set on exploration and curiosity, not on, you know, just getting laid or satisfying yourself or whatever, there's so much learning because there's no way things aren't going to come up, you know.
Well,
and so what comes up if you explore, whether that's with a therapist or a coach or just kind of examine and look at, those are all potentials to really grow and expand.
I will say I've grown more in my practice of polyamory than I probably have in years and years and years. Like when I say that there is like a huge growth curve on this, like if you are a personal growth junkie, this is going to get you there, right? Like you are going to learn so much about yourself, the world, other people, the nature of love, where like I thought I had a handle on what love was for me. Like, I thought I would, you know, I was like, I feel like I have NRE for years. Turns out it was just anxious attachment. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know squat about soft love, soft masculine. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about peaceful romance and what that looks like in the long term, right? And so these are things that I was introduced to through polyamory. And
can you say real quick, just like this would be the little box in the bottom of the book, what is soft love? What is peaceful romance?
For me, I guess like soft love is just like an open arms kind of place, right? Mm. Like being welcomed in for exactly who I am with almost zero expectations, just glad that I'm there kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that the peaceful romance that I have come into with my partner now, I just didn't know it could be like, I'm going to get emotional. Like, I just didn't know it could be like that. I think that, you know, there could be chaos all around us, but our love is never something that we ever fight for. Mm. It's something that we love into. And it's not that it's effortless, but it just is there.
You know what's kind of sad and telling at the same time is when you say soft love, I think about our friendships, right? Our friendships because there's nothing's at stake, and it's like they just almost love us without condition. They're the glove holding us, and then when we find a romantic partner, that soft love becomes hard. It becomes controlling. It can come with conditions and pressure, and that's just a great example on how. When you throw romance and intimacy into just love in general, it can swing that way. It can go that way. And then we get into the trap of thinking, oh, that's what love is. And it's not.
I think for me, I associated chaos with love because that was what happened in my family of origin.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people fall into this trap I was literally 18 years deep and looked up one day from my coffee and was like, shit. Oh my God, this is really, really bad. Yeah. And it took a lot to get there. And so if I have something to say about polyamory and about exploring various relationship styles, it's like, yeah, you're going to see it. Like, you're going to see it all. So don't be afraid to take the full journey. Like, as much chaos as all of that was for me, worth it. 100%. Like, it carried me, you know? And so I don't regret a thing, not a single thing, because I think in the end, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
It led to something really beautiful.
Yeah. You know, if before the pandemic, you told me that we're no longer going to work, we're not going to go into work, but we're going to Zoom, most of us, and we're not going to wear pants, we're just going to dress up from waist up, I would have thought you were crazy, and now that's the norm.
Yeah.
And I feel like when it comes to customizing your relationship or, you know, the like you said, relationship anarchy or just different models, I think we're going to, you know, okay, so if we're not even talking about poly and open, just the idea of a couple who's married but live in separate houses, that, like, before that'd be like blasphemy. That would be like, why you even get married then? But I think things like that are going to be more normal, and it's going to be just what people like and what works for them. You know,
I agree. Okay. And I really and truly believe that monogamy is also due for an overhaul, right?
Sure. Right.
And that's part of it, right? Like, I don't ever want to be the person who's like, polyamory is the best, do the polyamory. I don't care.
Yeah.
I want people to have radical control of themselves, right?
Yeah.
It's about autonomy. And that includes in monogamy, because monogamy, frankly, does a lot of damage to a lot of people, not because you're with one person, but because you've elevated this relationship to be everything. I mean, think about the ways, like when you're talking about friendship, for example, right? You've been through a divorce, I've been through a divorce, right? You know how essential friendships are at this point, right?
Yeah, and most people lose their friends or don't put any effort in their friends because they find love.
Yeah, we shouldn't be doing that. Like, a facet of monogamy even should be assessing the ways in which we are free to pursue friendship, to pursue travel, to pursue our careers. You know, these are important things.
Yeah. I love what you're saying, and thank you for the work that you are doing.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'll continue to have more conversations about this. It's such a hot topic. Every time I bring this up, people go crazy in the chats. I mean, I get it. It's love. People, you know, they will die they'll fight for it till, you know, it's a religion. It's politics. It's that kind of,
it's very sticky. Intersectional. It's very intersectional.
It's very personal. It's very personal and tied to identity. Yeah.
Very.
But you know what? I also feel like if there's that much activation, then it, like, I feel like let's turn over that rock. Let's see what's under it, you know?
Yeah. So, if you're triggered, go there.
Yeah.
Go there.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think Carl Jung would agree with us too. So
yes. where can we find you?
Well, I'm on Instagram.
Yep.
You know, I'm mostly here. I also have a Patreon. Like, if people want to take a deeper dive into relationship anarchy, polyamory, or just gain more access to my personal life, that's the place to do it, is my Patreon.
For people listening to this on my podcast, Annie Undone. So
at Annie _Undone.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, everyone.
John.
Be well. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.